Hello, and welcome back to the History of Australia podcast. As always, before we start, I do want to acknowledge that this podcast is being produced on traditional Kaurna land, and recognise the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region. I also pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future. This week, we continue looking through the Australian colonies, who are rapidly developing. Ongoing clashes, both in terms of squatting and transportation, continue during this period, as the Crown vies against the colonial governments, especially around the issue of convicts. These issues will take up much of our focus this week, as will the separation of Port Phillip as its own colony apart from New South Wales. However, before we get into those, we do need to discuss the disappearance of explorer Ludwig Leichhardt, whose journeys we discussed 2 weeks ago. Last we left Ludwig, he had been in modern-day Queensland, examining his and Thomas Mitchell's journals in regards to their expeditions in the area. By August 1847, he would be back in Sydney, attempting to organise a retry of his Swan River expedition, which, if you'll remember, ended disastrously. However, he had learned of explorer Edmund Kennedy's return, and is reporting that Mitchell's findings of a major river in the north, called the Victoria, were false, which gave Ludwig the belief that he was essentially alone in the field of exploration. Kennedy's story is actually quite interesting, as he would go on an expedition in April 1848 after revealing Mitchell's river to be false, attempting to traverse the Cape York Peninsula. However, this expedition would go awry due to the mangrove swamps and mountains in the region, with his party only moving 32 kilometres in 2 months. Though whilst sickness and food shortages began, Kennedy was said to have maintained an almost impossible optimism and cheeriness, which had kept the party going. This optimism wouldn't be enough though, as by November that year, he would leave 14 of his men at Weymouth Bay, while he and his men, a few others, went on. All but one there would starve, while those who pushed on would also die, with Kennedy being the last, and dying after being speared, in the arms of an indigenous boy who was acting as their guide, called Jackie Jackie. Jackie Jackie would actually make it out and tell the story, but Kennedy's story really shows the perils of the expeditions at this point. As such, when Ludwig began his expedition in March 1848, believing that he alone could solve the issues of Central Australia, it was clear that this may be overconfidence, which bordered on arrogance. This confidence seems to have been massively misplaced, as soon after he and his party of seven left McPherson Station in early April at Coogoon on the Darling Downs, they would disappear, with no conclusive evidence to their fate. Ludwig's disappearance is one of Australia's mysteries, as the evidence we do have in regards to his party fate is vague at best. Multiple trees in the region, all the way to the Barcoo River near modern-day Blackall, Queensland, and near the Flinders River at the Gulf of Carpentaria in far north Queensland, exhibit L marks on them. The same mark, which seems to have been found at a campsite discovered by the search expedition 4 years after the party's disappearance. But if these L marks are to do with Ludwig's final expedition, he would have been way off course from his intended destination. And perhaps it is more likely that they relate to his earlier ones towards Port Essington. Multiple rumours have been started of indigenous sites where the bones of the men and their horses had been circulated throughout the 1800s especially. But these all turned out not to be the men. Though meanwhile, other indigenous groups seemed to have possessions amongst them, which were distinctly European, but bore no distinct markings. In 2006, a brass nameplate bearing his name and the year 1848 was authenticated. While this might seem to be definitive evidence of his expedition, the issue occurs with where it was found. The nameplate, found with a burnt shotgun and a tree engraved with the letter L, was found in Sturt Creek, which sits between the Tanami and Great Sandy Deserts, just inside the Western Australia border near the Northern Territory. While the nameplate is genuine, such a find would mean that Ludwig and his party made it two-thirds of the way to their destination before perishing by some unknown means, seeing as their bodies still have not been found. On the other hand, there is oral history by the Wallumbilla people in the region of the Darling Downs and Maranoa, who state that Lightheart lived in the region for 10 years before being killed in an ambush, with his items possibly being circulated around. This could explain the distance of the European items if they were traded, but it does not explain the nameplate being found on a tree with the distinctive L mark. Ludwig's disappearance remains a mystery, mostly because there is no place of death. And though while he may have reached where the nameplate was, to get two-thirds the way across the continent in under a year, remember, he was in New South Wales in 1848, seems almost impossible when you consider that much of the area he and his party were traversing were completely unknown to them. I guess this is a question to you as an audience that you can continue to ponder and think about. Whether Ludwig's expedition truly made it to Western Australia? Whether they made it further, but just not to their destination? Or if they fell far shorter than the nameplate would suggest? Before we get into the political struggles of the rest of the continent, we can actually use this to stop over in Western Australia. The colony has continued to struggle with population growth, and while the Depression did not hit it too hard, it still did damage to the small population. However, Governor Hutt had managed to undo much of the misfortune which had met the colony under Stirling's governorship. While many of the colonists were suspicious of his close relationship to Wakefield and his ideas, especially with the failure of the Australian colony, his appointment of four free colonists to the Legislative Council, by then long overdue, did much to remove any hostility. Suspicion did remain due to his removal of land grants which had not yet been fulfilled or occupied, as the push systematic colonisation. Despite the concept's failure elsewhere, it did find some success under Hutt. Hutt would begin sending income to the Land and Emigration Commission, which was established in 1840, which in turn began sending hundreds of migrants over in the early 1840s, including around 70 boys from the Parkhurst prison, who were delinquents intended to be pardoned upon their arrival. Even with the Depression, Hutt managed to keep immigration up, and would change up Stirling's approach to the indigenous, removing segregation while still allowing them to nominally continue their beliefs in private, while also beginning this process of Christianizing and civilizing, though in rather small steps. Hutt would attempt to hold against the change in minimum acre price from 5 shillings to 12, but would eventually be forced in 1840. Though, he would be quick in introducing the £1 minimum price when land buying was high in 1841. By the end of his term in 1846, he had seen population steadily rise upwards, rather than the gains and the losses of Stirling, with the colony going from just under 2,000 in 1838 to over 4,500 by 1846. this still made the colony by far the smallest on the continent, in the low thousands compared to the tens of thousands for the rest. By 1846, New South Wales was about to breach the 200,000 mark, with Van Diemen's Land at just over 66,000, and South Australia over 25,000. Hutt left the colony in the hands of Governor Andrew Clark in January 1846, though Clark would die by February 1847, being replaced in the interim by Lieutenant Colonel Frederick Irwin, with his true successor being Charles Fitzgerald, who would arrive in August 1848. Western Australia's issues with growth would feed into the ongoing wider narrative to do with convict transportation. As you may remember, the colony of Swan River, and then the colony of Western Australia, was a colony that was built without convicts for the most part, though some did come both in the first ships over, and also throughout the years. The landowners and merchants of Perth would make a plea to the colonial office just as Hutt's time in office finished, stating that convicts were needed to increase the colony's prosperity and entice other migrants over, as the convicts could be used on public works projects, as they had been in places like New South Wales and Van Diemen's Land. This plea would only be reported to the public a year later in January 1847, when it was published in the Perth Gazette and Western Australian Journal. This would be alongside petitions made to the Legislative Council in Western Australia about establishing a penal colony in the region, though the Legislative Council would reject the petition outright. While the plea would go unanswered for now, the idea that Western Australia needed convicts would remain. And as more pastoralists made their way onto the Legislative Council, them being the group who wanted the convicts the most, alongside the pro-convict Governor Fitzgerald, the concept of a Western Australia as a home to convicts no longer seemed as far-fetched. The issue of convict transportation would continue to plague the colonies between 1846 and 1848. The issue stemmed from the fact that Britain, while working towards a far more effective penal system, still had convicts it wished to transport overseas. However, at this point in time, only Canada and Van Diemen's Land were accepting convicts from the British Isles, and most of these were transported with protest from the free colonists in those colonies. The majority of the colonists in New South Wales remained completely opposed to the transfer of convicts to the colony, and the attempts to send over exiles, as we discussed in episode 44, was not well received, with the majority of the 1,700 exiles sent between 1844 and 1849 sent down to Port Phillip. Even the squatters, who were preferential to the transportation of convicts, had come to realise it was a period at its end, and had begun searching for cheap labour through other means, which we will discuss next week. Nonetheless, the British government had continued to look for ways to continue the system. Port Phillip and Moreton Bay were both suggested as areas for transportation to continue, as was Sydney, though only briefly, as this caused major protests in the city. Gladstone, who had been Secretary of State in 1846, would go as far to state that Her Majesty's government hold it indispensable that within the Australian colonies, receptacles should be found for all convicts and exiles who may be sent from this country in execution of judicial sentences. This is so momentous an object of national policy that we can acknowledge no conflicting motive as of sufficient importance to supersede it. In essence, he believed that despite the protests of the colonists, the Crown should continue to transport convicts to the colonies. However, he would be out of the position by the end of 1846, succeeded by Earl Grey, who was more sympathetic to the protests of the colonists. Grey would, in 1847, announce the end of the convict system in New South Wales, with the convict establishment broken up. Those remaining convicts were either moved to Van Diemen's Land, or, if they were unable to be moved for whatever reason, they were kept in the colony with the upkeep being paid for by the British government. However, this did not end the issue. Despite him being on the side of the anti-transportation crowd, the exiles would still come to the colony, while at the same time, he would still have to deal with the colony of Port Curtis. Port Curtis was a penal colony designed by Gladstone during his time as Secretary of State. Looking for other ways to circumvent the protests and anti-transportation sentiment through the Eastern Australian colonies, he and his office would designate Port Curtis, located near modern-day Gladstone, north of Brisbane in Queensland, as a penal colony. In addition, Port Curtis would become the main city of an overall new colony known as North Australia, whose southern boundary was the 26th parallel all the way into Western Australia, essentially compromising of modern-day Northern Territory and North Queensland. Port Curtis's superintendent and lieutenant governor would be George Barney, while Governor Fitzroy of New South Wales would remain the colony's overall governor. Authorised by the Letters Patent on the 17th of February 1846, it would not be brought into physical existence until a year later, on the 30th of January. Gladstone's idea for the colony would be one similar to that of early New South Wales and Van Diemen's Land, or of Norfolk Island, in that a small base of military and officials would conduct a larger population of convicts. In essence, Port Curtis was meant to circumvent the anti-transportation sentiment entirely, and as New South Wales did not have laws against the travel of convicts to their state from elsewhere, unlike South Australia, it was believed that these convicts could be transferred south over time. However, by the time that the colony was actually settled, Gladstone was no longer in his role as Secretary of State, having, as mentioned previously, been replaced by Earl Grey. Grey would immediately close down the colony. However, news would not arrive until mid-April. Even ignoring the closing down, the colony had been in strife due to the heat, humidity, and general tropic nature of its location, which meant that it likely wouldn't have succeeded significantly anyway. Nonetheless, the colony was closed down, and the colony of North Australia reabsorbed into the colony of New South Wales. The end of Port Curtis would essentially end the issue in New South Wales, though the exiles would still come. However, elsewhere in Australia, convict transportation would remain alive and relatively active. Our final topic this week is the beginning of the separation of the Port Phillip District and Melbourne from New South Wales. The Port Phillip District had, since its inception, been a part of the colony of New South Wales. This meant that their governor was always the governor of New South Wales and Sydney, and as we discussed in their last episode, that they did not have their own legislative council, instead being tied to the New South Wales ones with 6 seats. While this was not a large issue early on in the colony's existence, as Melbourne was small and did not have much need for the positions of authority afforded to the other colonies. However, by the 1840s, the district was far larger than its origins would suggest. Melbourne and the Port Phillip District were far larger than Western Australia, and by this point, likely were larger than both South Australia and Van Diemen's Land, or at least of a similar population size. As such, to those living in the region, it no longer made sense for themselves and their businesses to be represented by those far off in Sydney. This would be the start of agitation and protest for the separation of Port Phillip from the New South Wales colony. The first attempt at a formal separation would be done by Commissioner for the Crown Lands of the Port Phillip District, Henry Fish Gisborne. Gisborne, a politically active member of the district in Melbourne, would be the first individual to collect signatures for a petition regarding the separation, doing so after his resignation from the position in May 1840. He would attend public meetings, using what energy he had left from an illness to push for the separation, and on his return to England, would stop in Sydney to personally provide Governor Gipps with the petition, alongside an interview with the governor to convince him. Gipps, though not opposed to the separation, had taken a disliking to Gisborne during his stint as commissioner, and would reject the petition. With that, Gisborne would sail back to England, dying less than a year later in April 1841. From here, the separation of the Port Phillip district fell into the background, as more pressing matters, such as the Depression, took the forefront of the government's mind. However, as that subsided, the cause would be once more taken up by the colonists in the district. They would go so far as to claim that they were never an extension of New South Wales, and rather had been colonised from both Britain but also Van Diemen's Land, which, if you look at the first colonists such as Batman, isn't entirely false. In addition, they would regularly protest that despite having the population and ability to govern in the same sense as Australia's other colonies, that they were instead treated to feel like strangers in their own region, and that their interests were being controlled by strangers elsewhere. In a campaign for their separation, the colonists of the region would go to the 1848 polls with only this in their mind. Those in Melbourne, with only one delegate, would nominate and then elect Secretary of State Earl Grey. Grey had never so much even visited Australia, and most questioned if he even met the property requirements to be nominated. But as is obvious, this vote was meant more as a protest than anything else. It was likely twofold, both working as a boycott of the New South Wales Legislative Council, while also attempting to get the attention of one of the men back in Britain who could change the situation. Meanwhile, the colonists of Port Phillip would nominate not a single person for the initial election, choosing to boycott the entire thing. They would be returned to the polls once more a month later in late August, and while they would elect five actual candidates, a combined ticket of five British parliamentarians, including the Duke of Wellington Arthur Wellesley, Lord Palmerston, Lord Brougham, Lord John Russell, and Sir Robert Peel, would gain 4% of the vote, once again as a protest. Even the voting numbers demonstrate the level of protest going on, as despite significant growth occurring during the 5 years between elections, Melbourne would actually have less voters overall, with the reduction in voters likely down to those boycotting the election. Such an effort forced the New South Wales government and the Colonial Office to reconsider the possibility of separating the Port Phillip district from the New South Wales colony. And this is where we'll head next week. This week, we've seen the ongoing trend of conflict between the Crown and its colonial subjects in Australia continue to grow. This will not change next week, as we discuss the final separation of the Port Phillip district, the new, and probably inhumane, way in which the squatters were bringing in cheap labour with the end of the convict system, and how the first convicts started coming to Western Australia. And amongst all these political squabbles and strife, more and more reports are coming in, whispered amongst those who know, and rumoured amongst those who don't, that Australia might just be filled with gold.